At the end of my talk, I'll come to an optimization problem just to show that I'm interested in OR and optimization. But first, I'd like to introduce a new problem that was the question was posed by two engineers in Budapest, Gábor Domokos and Krisztina Tóth. They started investigating this problem. It has to do with geometric sensitivity. They call this property that I'll talk about geometric sensitivity. And it turns out to be, an interesting problem. So the main results will be about two-dimensional frameworks, but still it's interesting to see that there are new questions, unsolved problems, even in 2D. So to define this problem, let's have a look at some basic definitions, and also let's look at the notation. So everybody in this room is familiar with these concepts. So a two-dimensional framework, GP is a pair, G is a graph, and P is a map from V to R2. And now, in this talk, the main, one of the main, most important notions we need is a load, an equilibrium load. And what is it? A load is an assignment of vectors to the vertices, informally speaking, without translational or rotational components. More precisely, such a load, if we look at it as a vector of length 2v, then it's an equilibrium load if it is orthogonal to the kernel of the rigidity matrix of the complete graph. Right? So it's a more precise definition of an equilibrium load. It works for all d. So this is an equilibrium load. In 2D, we have two vectors assigned to the vertices. And this is an equilibrium load, and we can also look at it as a long vector of size 2V. Okay. Well, now we say that a resolution of such an equilibrium load on the framework is a stress, which is an assignment of numbers, real numbers to the edges, such that for each vertex, this equilibrium equation is satisfied. So here we have this, at this particular vertex V, we have this red 2D vector, it's vertex I, so it's vertex I is Li, so we have this component of this equilibrium load, and the stress condition for equilibrium condition for this vertex is that the load plus this Pi minus Pj times the stresses, so this sum should be equal to zero. This is the equilibrium condition for a vertex. And as you know, if the framework is infinitesimally rigid, then every equilibrium load can be resolved by such a stress. I'll come back to this in a minute. Just a few examples. So here, the first one is a planar framework on four joints and five bars, and we have two non-zero components of an equilibrium load, the red arrows and the black numbers indicate the stresses that resolve this load, right? If you can check that for these, for this load and this stress, the equilibrium conditions are satisfied, right? So I should maybe remark here that engineers would sort of normalize the stress and would look at the normalized version. So instead of, for an engineer, this minus one in the middle would be minus square root of two, right? And that would satisfy the equilibrium conditions. But now we follow this mathematician's terminology. The second example, I think I just wanted to mention that all the problem itself and definitions and the results can be extended to pinned frameworks as well. I won't talk about pinned frameworks. It's easy to extend everything to the case when there are pinned vertices. In this example with this car, you can see that you cannot resolve this load coming from this force. Okay, and now here we have a stress. On the third example, we have a stress which resolves the zero, uniformly zero equilibrium load. So it's also called a self-stress, as you know very well. So this third example is the self-stress on this redundantly rigid framework. The last example, it's a simple example, it shows that if you have a vertex Vi on which the component of the load is zero, and the two bars incident with this vertex, so it's a vertex of degree two, the two bars are not collinear, then the only way to satisfy the equilibrium equation is that the stresses must be zero on these two bars or edges. So these degree two vertices will have a special role in this problem. Okay, so this is just a little warm up, and now we can define the problems. We have two problems, or even three problems if we include the optimization problem that I mentioned. So the first problem is this one. Suppose that we have an equilibrium load, so loads in this talk are equilibrium loads. So suppose that we have a load on GP, and we have a designated vertex V on which the load is zero. And now suppose that we change the position of V a little bit, and apply the same load on the rest of the framework. The question is, in which bars or edges will the stress change? Right? This is the question one. And we call this the influence zone of V with respect to L, P, and P prime. And P prime is the new framework in which the position of V has been modified. Right? So this is the influence zone of V. Okay, this is the first problem, and we want to say something about the influence zone. Okay. The second problem is a similar flavor, it's a bit different. So we have a load on a framework, and the non-zero components of this load, the vertices on which the load has a non-zero component, they all belong to some specified subset of vertices F. The question is, in which bars or edges will the stress that resolves L be non-zero, right? So in some bars, maybe we don't really need those bars to resolve the stress. And the question is, what is this so-called active zone of S with respect to P and L? This is the second question. And well, I'll tell you the main goal. The final goal is to show that if the framework is generic and the load is in some sense typical, then the influence zone and the active zone, these zones depend only on the graph of the framework. So it's similar to other results. We say that rigidity, infinitesimal rigidity, and so on, depend only on the graph and can be described by combinatorial methods if everything is generic or typical. So this is our goal, to show that for these zones, we have...
I guess it's not a little clearer. Do you have one example that shows the influence zone and the active zone of one?
Yes.
Do you have a show? Is this visible there?
First a trivial example. If we yeah, if you have a minimally, infinitesimally rigid framework, then the stress resolving a load is unique, and then
yes.
So we'll start with minimally, infinitesimally rigid framework. That's right. Okay. So back to Handy's question. So a trivial example has to do with this last drawing here. So if you have a degree two vertex like this, then the influence zone of this vertex is empty, right? Because if we move this vertex, we know that the every load which has a zero component on Vi will be resolved by a stress which is zero on these two bars, and therefore we can sort of freely move Vi and have the same stresses. But if the degree of Vi is larger, then this won't be the case, and there will be, in fact, the stress will change in this typical situation on all the bars incident with Vi, and also on some other bars. And this will form the influence zone. And I'll draw other examples later. So for the
only one node. Only one node.
One node. What is one node? All vertices, all vertices. So in this influence zone problem, the only assumption that we make is that on Vi, on this designated vertex, the load is zero. It's an unloaded vertex that we move, and on the rest can be anything. In fact, we are interested in the typical situation, and there is a non-zero load everywhere.
Relative to a specific load, how does it change the reaction to that load?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And it depends on the configuration P also, and also the new position of Vi. But the main result is say that if everything is generic P and also the load is typical in some sense, then this zone can be described in a purely combinatorial way. I'll show you examples where the framework is not generic or the load is not typical, and then interesting things happen. Okay. Okay, so these are the zones are the objects that we are interested in. This is not interesting. So maybe something about the motivation. So first motivation, which maybe may not be appealing to an engineer, I don't know. So suppose that we want to recompute the stresses after minor changes in the geometry, in the configuration. Now, if we can find, say, by a quick combinatorial pre-processing step, the influence zone, then it may be useful from the algorithmic point of view. We don't have to deal with the whole framework, we don't have to recompute all the stresses. It's enough to focus on the influence zone. And in some frameworks, the zones may be rather small, and then it gives an algorithmic improvement. Right? Okay. Another motivation was suggested by my co-author, who is an engineer. So he said that they have some devices that can change the stress in a bar. They attach something to the bar, and then they can sense if the stress has changed. So suppose that we want to observe these minor changes. So we want to know whether certain joints are moving in the framework, and we want to observe these minor changes by sensing the change of stresses in some bars. And then, in this case, perhaps we would go for a smallest subset of such sensing devices. And if we have a characterization for the influence zones, then it will help find a smallest set of such sensing devices. Say, right? This is this is another type of motivation, and they are just sort of opposite goals. So if we want this algorithmic sort of speed up step with these pre-processing steps, then it's better to have a non-sensitive framework. Non-sensitive means that the influence zones are small. And in the second application, it's better to have a highly sensitive framework in which the influence zones are large. And then probably in that case, we'll need a smaller number of such devices. Right? So just two related problems where the characterization of these zones may be useful. Okay. Yeah, it's not really necessary, but let me quickly go through this transparency. So you all know these concepts. Walter also introduced the rigidity matrix of this framework. So if we have a two-dimensional framework GP, then the rigidity matrix is an E by 2V matrix, and as you know very well, there is a row corresponding to every edge, and in the row of BIVJ, we have PVI minus PVJ in the two columns corresponding to VI, PVJ minus PVI in the two columns corresponding to VJ, and all the other entries are zeros. So if we look at the rigidity matrix, then we can rewrite these equilibrium conditions that hold for each vertex in this form, and you can see that what we really want is that when we are interested in a stress that resolves a given equilibrium load, is we want a linear combination of the rows of the rigidity matrix with these coefficients omega ij, for which we have this equality. So here is the load, and we want the coefficients in the linear combination will be the stresses. And then this basic result tells us that if we have a framework, then these three things are equivalent. So first, GP is statically rigid or infinitesimally rigid. It's the same. It's equivalent to saying that the rigidity matrix has rank 2V minus 3, the maximum possible rank in 2D. And this is equivalent to C, which says that each equilibrium load can be resolved by a stress. You can see, right, so the vector space of equilibrium loads has dimension 2V minus 3, right? So they are the vectors, as I mentioned, that are orthogonal to the kernel of the rigidity matrix of the complete graph. And so you can see that these vectors of length 2v, the equilibrium loads, they form a vector space of dimension 2v minus 3. And the infinitesimally rigid says exactly the same. It says that the row space has dimension 2v minus 3, and therefore every equilibrium load can be resolved by such a stress. There is a linear combination of the rows of the rigidity matrix, which gives the equilibrium load. Okay, now two simple observations that work any dimension D. Maybe let's start with this one. Suppose that we have a minimally statically or infinitesimally rigid framework in RD, and suppose that we have a sub-framework which is also minimally, say, infinitesimally rigid, such that this designated vertex V and its neighbor set, all these vertices belong to the vertex set of H, right? So a sub-framework which contains V and its neighbor set and is also minimally infinitesimally rigid. Now, it's not hard to observe that this thing, this is the influence zone of V, I, V, depends on G, L, P, and P prime, that the influence zone will be a subset of EH. So if there is such a minimally rigid subframework, then we know that in the complement of the subframework, the stresses will not change if we change the position of V. Why is that? Let me draw a figure, because it also introduce a notation here. So, okay. So here is this designated vertex V and its neighbor set. And here we have this subframework age, which includes V as well. It's also minimally infinitesimally rigid subframework of this minimally infinitesimally rigid framework GP. Let me use this notation here, right? So suppose that we move V, and the new position of V is here. Now, let's construct an extended framework, by adding a new vertex to the new position of V, and all the edges from V to the neighbor set of V, right? It's a new framework. It has one extra joint, and it is connected to the same vertices that V is connected to, right? Now, we are interested in the influence zone. So it's a minimally rigid framework. So in this original framework, there is a unique stress W that resolves L. And in the new framework, there is omega prime, that resolves the same L. Right? Remember that the load is zero on the designated vertex. Right? So if you look at this extended framework that I denote by G star P star, then we may observe that W minus W prime, or omega minus omega prime, is a self-stress on G star P star. We may look at omega as a stress in G star by extending it by zeros on the corresponding bars. So omega minus omega prime is a self stress on G star P star. But where can we have a non-zero self-stress in this G star P star? So we started with this minimally infinitesimally rigid GP and added this new vertex and some new bars. Now, since this HP here is minimally infinitesimally rigid, you can see that adding this vertex V and at least D bars, it will increase the rank by 2 in 2D. And the point is that it's not hard to observe that all these bars here are bridges, non-redundant, essential in G star, P star. So since we have attached this new vertex to a rigid subgraph, all these bars here remain essential, non-redundant. So since this is a self-stress on G star P star, and the self-stress must be zero on the bars outside of HP, we conclude that the non-zero components of this, and therefore the influence zone, edges that belong to the influence zone, must be inside HP. It's an easy observation. I just wanted to introduce this notation, G star, P star, this extended framework, because the results will be formulated by using this G star, P star. Okay, so this is a simple observation, And it's even there is an even simpler observation about the active zone. If we have a don't Walter, okay, yeah, thanks. So the second observation is almost straightforward. That if we have a second one is about the active zones. So if we have a we are interested in the active zone of a specified subset S, and if we have a minimally infinitesimally rigid subframework HP that contains S, and the active zone must be inside this HP. It's easy to see because HP itself can resolve the load. Remember that the non-zero components of the load are all in S. So since HP can resolve this load here, we can simply extend it by, I mean, the stress. We can extend the stress by zeros here, and then we obtain the unique stress that can that resolve this thing here. Okay, so that's very simple observations. And now the question is, okay, what to do in the generic case? And we shall see that if everything is generic or typical, then the smallest minimally rigid subframework with the corresponding properties is unique. There is a smallest unique minimally rigid subframework of that type in the influence zone case, and also of this type in the active zone case. And this can be described in a combinatorial way. And the statement will be that in this generic situation, the influence zone and the active zone, they are they correspond to this unique smallest rigid subgraph that contains V and its neighbor set, or that contains S. Okay. And now maybe now some examples showing that in the non-generic case it's maybe anything can happen. So example one is about okay maybe the active zone case, right? So I here is a minimally rigid graph, and suppose that we have an equilibrium load with non-zero components here, 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 and here. Now, where is the active zone? Where are the bars with a non-zero stress? Now, if the framework is non-generic, if these three vertices here, they are collinear, and you can see that only this part of the framework, only in this part, we can resolve such a load. Why? Why is that? Because the remember that the load is zero here. The load, the non-zero components are here, 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 and here. And you can see that such a load, we could resolve such a load by using this infinitesimally rigid framework. But since the load here is zero, we can replace this bar by these two bars. And therefore, we can resolve it by this subgraph, which is in generic circumstances is not infinitesimally rigid, but in this case it is. So this example shows that for any equilibrium load, if the configuration is not generic, then the active zone can be strictly smaller than this sort of this conjectured active zone, the unique smallest rigid subgraph which contains S. Okay, and now example two is about the influence zones. Example two, it shows that, I like to show that even if the framework is generic for certain equilibrium loads, the influence zone can be smaller. And to do that, I like to show you a method how to obtain such a load, such an influence zone. So suppose that we have this framework GP. Here is this designated vertex V, and we look at this extended framework G star P star. Here is this HP that I drew there. Maybe this is this smallest minimal rigid subframework with this property. But what I want to say is that suppose that in this G star P star there is a self stress which is zero on some bar here. So maybe we have a self stress on these bars, maybe also on some other bars. It's a W hat. Suppose that we have such a self stress. Now, how can we obtain an equilibrium load for which the influence zone is smaller than what it should be, so that this bar will not belong to the influence zone? What we do is we, in the original framework, here is V, we look at the those bars on which this omega hat is non-zero. We forget about this part. So here these are non-zero stresses. We extend this to a stress on GP arbitrarily. If we define a stress, then there is a unique equilibrium load that it resolves. So extend the red part in GP to a stress, and there is a corresponding load. There is a load L resolved by this omega. Extend this to a stress omega. Okay? And now simply subtract omega hat from this omega. Omega hat is a self stress. The self stress on G star P star. So when we subtract this omega hat from this stress, then what happens is that it will resolve the same equilibrium load on these bars. We get zeros, and on these bars we get minus omega hat, which is okay because here the load is zero and it was an equilibrium stress. So what I want to say is that if there is a self stress in this extended framework which is zero on some bar here, it may happen. It's easy to construct examples. In fact, in most examples we can find such a self stress. Then we can construct a load for which the influence zone is a proper subset of this minimally rigid subframework. So these examples are to indicate that if the configuration is non-generic, then we have no control on the active zone. Even if the configuration is generic, we have no real control on the influence zone for some loads that we have constructed here. Okay. So mm, something that you know again very well, that if we have a generic configuration, then rigidity depends only on the graph, and in 2D we have Lahmann theorem, which describes which gives a necessary and sufficient condition for independence in the corresponding rigidity matroid for generic frameworks. So this just to recall that for generic frameworks we know everything about independence, minimal rigidity, rigidity, and so on. And now we look at the combinatorial part. We look at the combinatorial part that I promised. Suppose that G is minimally rigid. Now we are talking about generic frameworks, or equivalently we are talking about graphs now. So we have a minimally rigid graph. Then we may define this subgraph CAB for a given vertex pair. CAB is the smallest minimally rigid subgraph containing A and B. We can do that, in fact, for any subset C of capital S, for any subset S of cardinality at least 2. CS is the smallest minimally rigid subgraph containing S. And it's very easy. It's, by using some well-known lemmas, one can prove that CAB and in general C of S is unique for any S. We have these intersection union properties. It's very easy. And in fact, we can say more. So not only we have this uniqueness property, the smallest such subgraph, but we have this little lemma which is useful from the algorithmic point of view and also for the proof. So suppose that now we have a graph G and this designated vertex set S. So the subgraph induced by this vertex set may not be rigid, there may not be edges at all. So what we do is we add a set B of new edges and make this subgraph on S minimally rigid. It's just an auxiliary set of edges. We are interested in this subset S, and we make it rigid by some new edges. We make it minimally rigid by some new edges. And then the first part of the lemma says that this unique smallest subgraph, C of S, can be obtained by taking the union of these CABs for all these vertex pairs AB, where AB is either corresponds to an edge on S or in one of these auxiliary edges. So it's a technical lemma. The point here is that we can obtain C of S by using these CABs for certain vertex pairs. So this unique smallest rigid subgraph containing S can be obtained easily if we have a subroutine for computing these CABs. And in fact, how can we find CAB, the unique smallest rigid subgraph which contains AB? Well, it's nothing but the unique circuit in the rigidity matroid that we get by after adding the edge AB to the graph. And then we look at this unique circuit and remove AB, and then this is this CAB. It is easy. It's easy. So if we can find these fundamental circuits in the rigidity matroid, then with this equality we can easily build up this C of S for any set S. Okay? Also shows that it's easy to find in an algorithmic sense, this C of S. And now the second part says that if we take an edge which belongs to this unique smallest rigid subgraph, maybe it's not written there, I call it the core of S, the C of S. So if we take an edge which is not induced by S, but it belongs to the core of S, to this subgraph, then we have this property that if we remove such an edge E, then some vertex pair in S becomes loose, right? So we are in a minimally rigid graph. We have S and the larger set C of S, and we remove an edge from which is in C of S but not in S, and then we make at least one pair in S loose. Loose, one way to define it is that they do not belong to the same to a rigid subgraph. There is an infinitesimal motion or real motion which moves them apart from each other, right? So this little part B is actually the key step in proving that in the generic case the active zone is equal to this core. Okay. Yes, maybe an example here to illustrate this. Here is a minimally rigid graph, and this set S consists of three vertices A, B, C. We want to find the core. We want to find the core of this S, C of S. What we do is we add these extra edges. This is capital B. So what is it? It's a set of edges which would make the subgraph on S rigid. So the subgraph on vertices A, B, C has no edges at the moment. So we add three edges. We make it a triangle with these auxiliary edges. We add AB, BC, and CA. AB, BC, and CA. And this previous lemma said that what we have to do now is we have to compute these kind of this fundamental circuits for AB, BC, and CD. So the fundamental circuit of AB, that is the unique circuit that we obtain by adding AB, is this K4, would be the K4 on A, P, B, and Q. If we add BC, then the unique circuit would be the K4 on B, Q, C, and R. And if we add AC, then the unique circuit will be a, what is it? It will be a wheel graph centered at Q, and the rim would be A, P, B, R, C, and back to A. And then we take these fundamental circuits and we take their union, and it is the core of S. And the union of all these circuits is this minimally rigid subgraph on vertex set A, P, B, Q, C, and R. So this is just to illustrate this technical lemma, how can we obtain the core of ABC by using the cores of vertex pairs. Okay. Now I state the results. So you saw that by these examples, the genericity of the framework is essential. Also, some sort of genericity of the load is also essential, because we could construct bad equilibrium loads in the second example. So this is what I hope you can see. Yes, first theorem. What is it? We have a minimally rigid framework. So it's about the influence zone. We relocate V, and the condition here is that this extended framework G star P star should be generic, right? Suppose that it is generic, and also suppose that the degree of this vertex is at least 3. We have observed that if it's a degree 2 vertex, then the influence zone problem is uninteresting. So if a degree at least 3, then for all equilibrium loads, this L of V, it is the vector space of those equilibrium loads which have a zero component on V. So remember we said that on this designated vertex, the load must be zero. So this is this here is the vector space of these special equilibrium loads. And the theorem says that for all such equilibrium loads, with perhaps except loads that belong to finitely many proper subspaces, there may be some exceptions in this form. So with this tiny exception, each edge of this core, each edge of the core of the neighbor set of V belongs to the influence zone. And then a corollary of this is the next theorem, that if we have the same setup, a minimal, the generically rigid framework, relocate V, we have G star P star, and the vertex has degree at least 3, then if the load is typical, and now typical is defined with respect to G, P, and P prime. And the non-typical would mean that it belongs to one of those small subspaces. So if it is typical, then we have this equality. The influence zone depends only on the graph. It is the core of the neighbor set of V. This is the result for the influence zone. We look at the neighbor set of V, take the unique smallest rigid subgraph which contains V, and this is the influence zone. It's easy to see that if V has degree at least 3, then V itself must belong to this rigid subgraph. So the influence zone will contain V and its neighbor set, and maybe some more vertices. So this is what I promised, that in this generic and typical case, it can be found by combinatorial algorithm. It depends only on the graph. And now you can imagine the next results. I just show you. That's the same thing for the active zone. It should be a script L here. Doesn't matter. So we look at those equilibrium loads, the vector space of the equilibrium loads, which have only zero components in V minus S. And now, again, if we have such an equilibrium load, and maybe with the exception of finitely many proper subspaces in the corresponding vector space, then the stress that resolves L will be non-zero on all edges of this core, of the core of S, and therefore we have a similar equality showing that we can eliminate the dependence on L and P, and in this generic and typical case, the active zone depends only on the graph. Okay, so this is these are the main results for minimally rigid two-dimensional frameworks. And now, before I make some remarks about the rigid case, so not necessarily minimally rigid, but rigid case, let me show you a simple observation. It's just one can play with these influence zones. One way to play with these zones is to define the sensitivity index of a graph. So we take the sum of the cardinalities of the vertex sets of the influence zones. For each vertex, we take I, V, G, and the number of vertices in it, and we divide this by V squared. You may define other indices, but this is one, the sensitivity index. And I just want to show this simple observation that there is an infinite family of minimally rigid graphs for which the sensitivity index is equal to 1. Just highly, very, very sensitive graphs. And to do that, we look at this family of special graphs. We investigated this family in a different context. They are interesting in global rigidity as well, but they can be used here too. So with Bill, we defined this family, a minimally rigid graph is special if every proper rigid subgraph is complete. So a complete subgraph in a minimally rigid graph is either a single edge or a triangle. So in other words, it's special if every proper rigid subgraph is an edge or a triangle. There cannot be larger proper rigid subgraphs. And by the results that I showed you, these results show that the influence zone of the vertex is a rigid subgraph. So if the influence zone of a vertex is not everything, then it's a proper rigid subgraph. But the influence zone of a vertex of degree 3, it's the core of its neighbor set, it cannot be complete. So it's easy to see that for this family, in this family, you can see that there are no vertices of degree 2. So for this family, the influence zone must be equal to the vertex set. And therefore, they are highly sensitive. Okay? And now, the next question. What if the graph is rigid, but not minimally rigid? First question is how to define the active zone, for example, if it's not minimally rigid, because as you know, the stress is not unique. So somehow you have to specify, you have to define it. And one way to define it is this: we can say that if we have a rigid graph, then an edge is in the active zone of some designated vertex set S if there exists a minimally rigid spanning subgraph of G for which E is in the active zone of S in H. It turns out to be equivalent to some other natural definitions, but anyway, this is how we define the active zone in an arbitrary rigid graph. So it's in a we take all minimally rigid spanning subgraphs, we take the active zone of S in each of them, and then take the union. This is the active zone. And really, I have no time to explain the details of how to even the statement here, but I just want to show you which properties of the graphs and which concepts are important here. So without understanding all details, let's have a look at this more general result. So suppose that we have a rigid graph in 2D, generically rigid. We have a designated vertex set of size at least 2. And again, we add these extra edges that make the subgraph on S rigid. Okay, it's a technical thing. And now, what is the active zone? And now we can say that an edge belongs to the active zone of S in G, if and only if, and now it's the connective components of the rigidity matroid play a role here. So R of G prime is this extended graph, so R of G prime is the two-dimensional rigidity matroid of G prime, and perhaps you know the concept of a connected matroid. So perhaps this rigidity matroid, it may not be a connected matroid, in which case it has at least two connected components in this matroid sense. And then if the connected component containing F intersects this EGS union B, then it belongs to the active zone, and otherwise it doesn't. So I just wanted to show you that in the general case, the matroid connected components determine the active zone, and also the influence zone. So this is another problem where this matroid connectivity concept is useful. It's useful in global rigidity, in 2D, as well, and also other places. Okay. Now I have I have maybe two minutes to talk about this optimization problem that I mentioned at the beginning. So after characterizing the zones in generic two-dimensional frameworks, one may formulate this optimization problem, which I think it makes some sense. Here it is. So we have a minimally rigid generic realization of some graph, and we want to find the smallest subset for which a typical equilibrium load on this subset will induce or generate non-zero stresses everywhere, right? So we want to push or framework, but we want to push just a very small subset of joints, but generate a non-zero stress in all bars. And it is certainly an optimization problem, how to find the smallest such set T. And by using these results, it is possible to find an optimizer, a smallest T. Maybe this observation, we can look at it. So a straightforward observation is that T is a feasible solution. That is, it has a if we push the framework at the vertices of T, then we generate non-zero stresses everywhere. So it's a feasible solution if and only if for every non-trivial rigid proper subgraph, T contains at least one vertex from its complement. Why is that? So if you look at this sort of truncated wheel here, it's a minimally rigid graph, you can see that this set T, these three vertices, it's not a feasible solution, because if we push here, here, and here, then what we are interested in, of course, is the active zone, by using the previous terminology. We want the active zone to be the whole graph. But for these three vertices, the active zone will not be the whole graph, because there is a smaller, a proper rigid subgraph containing these vertices. So by the previous results, the core of this vertex set will be a proper subset of V, and therefore it's not a feasible solution. On the other hand, in this graph here, in the prism, just pushing these two vertices is okay. This vertex pair is a feasible solution because we know it's a special graph, so there is no proper rigid subgraph. And if we push two independent vertices, it implies that the core of this vertex pair must be the whole set. So these are just examples here. And then the optimization problem, if you reformulate the optimization problem by using this observation, then maybe I'll show you, this is my last page here. We can define, so these are the interesting subsets in this problem, these co-rigid subsets of vertices. Set is co-rigid if its complement is a rigid subgraph on at least two vertices, so it's a proper rigid subgraph. And by the previous observation, we want to find the smallest subset of vertices that hits every co-rigid subgraph. This is equivalent to our optimization problem, finding the smallest hitting set or cover, sometimes called in combinatorial optimization. We want to find the smallest cover of the co-rigid subsets in a minimally rigid graph. And here is the lemma, which shows that we can do that. The lemma says that if you have a minimally rigid graph, then at least one of the following holds. First, there is a feasible solution of size 2. This is an easy case, easy to test. If for some vertex pair, this subset is feasible. So either there is a very small feasible solution, which covers or hits every co-rigid set, or the minimal co-rigid subsets are pairwise disjoint. So why is it useful? How can we deduce from this lemma that we can find an optimal solution? So if we are in case one, then this is fine. We try each vertex pair. This is okay. Now how can we find the smallest hitting set if we know that the minimal co-rigid subsets are pairwise disjoint? You can see that if they are covering every co-rigid subset is equivalent to covering every inclusion-wise minimal co-rigid subset, clearly. But if they are pairwise disjoint, then every optimal solution must contain exactly one from each. So therefore, simply a greedy type deletion algorithm will work. We start with T equals V, and try to delete vertices one by one. And every time we check if the new subset T after deleting a vertex is a feasible solution or not. And by this pairwise disjoint property, we must end up with a set T which contains exactly one vertex from each. This is a very simple property that if we are looking for a smallest hitting set for a family satisfying this property, then this greedy strategy works. So it's this shows that it can be computed in polynomial time. And the subroutine that we need is we have to, in every iteration, we have to test whether the active zone of the current T is equal to V or not. And for this, we have to compute the core of T, and that we can compute by taking the unions of some fundamental circuits, as you saw in one of the previous lemmas. Okay, thank you for your attention.